Welcome to Mustard Andy's. I am Richard.
I'm Matt.
And we riff. I always forget the hell we riff on. What do we do?
It's stuff in the entertainment industry. It's movies, DVDs, TV.
Anything that strikes our fancy.
Which is a slightly gay way of putting it, but is accurate nonetheless. Okay, well, let me get my list back in front of me here. First on the list today, Lucky Number 11 opened this weekend.
What do you think of that title, by the way?
It's a little irritating, but you try not to judge the quality of a movie by the title.
This is true.
I had a buddy who wanted to see it this weekend, and I was a little mezzo, and I decided, I think since I haven't really heard anything in the buzz, that I'm going to check Rotten Tomatoes, which came up with 45%. And, at 45%, I might enjoy it. I'm not going to pay money to find out.
I can't think of the specific movies, but I can think of times when movies have gotten essentially 30 to 40% and I've loved the movie. Right. And I can think of a couple movies that got dang near like 95%, which I liked the movie, didn't love. And I sort of realized most critics liked the movie and didn't love them. They all thought it was a pretty good movie, but didn't love it. So Rotten Tomatoes is a good starting point for me, but it's like you're sort of alluding to. It's not like an end-all, be-all.
Well, and for me, it's just, how do I want to spend my time and money?
Yeah.
And with that, it wasn't quite the endorsement I needed to do either.
Yeah.
So, and it's got a lot of people in it. Josh Hartnett, Bruce Willis, Lucy Liu, who every time I think of Lucy Liu now, I think of Lucy Liubot from Futurama.
That is like about one of my all-time favorite episodes.
Well, plus they brought her back for a couple other cameos, which were like throwaway jokes in other episodes. It was fantastic.
And it's got Morgan Freeman in it, too.
Especially when Bender was keeping her head in his in his compartment. All right. Morgan Freeman, John Malkovich. It looks really interesting, but all the negative review blurbs I saw said, trying too hard to be Tarantino-esque.
Yeah.
Which just kind of, I'll see it when I don't have to pay for it.
Yeah.
Also, of note this weekend, you wanted to mention Failure to Launch.
Oh, yeah. I was just noticing. I was looking on the... God, what do you call it? The sites where they add up the numbers. And this movie's like up to like $90 million. And I was like, what the hell? I thought that movie like came and went. And it occurred to me that, boy, if there's like a dearth of romantic comedies in the marketplace, you throw one in there, it's going to make a crap load of money. Just like a comedy, just like a horror movie. And
every niche needs to be served at once.
And it's almost, not totally, but almost irrespective of quality. As long as it's just semi-quality, because I haven't heard any good reviews of Failure to Launch, but I haven't heard it's horrible. I've just heard it's just this average, stupid romantic comedy, but my God, it's up there over $100 million soon.
And, it's got Matthew McConaughey and Sarah Jessica Parker.
Yeah.
And Matthew McConaughey is one of my girlfriend's imaginary boyfriends, if you will. And even she could muster up no enthusiasm to see this thing.
Yeah.
Which I think is a little telling, although I'm a little interested by the casting of Terry Bradshaw as the dad.
Terry Bradshaw. I do like Terry Bradshaw.
I do, too. The guy is such a ham. But he's
such a ham and such a hick.
But he's so self-aware of him being what he is. Anyway, you're right. It's supremely irritating that such a mediocre film can make so much money and just perpetuate the cycle of mediocreness. But
well, in the realm of go see it in the theater because I want to see it, go see it in the theater because there's nothing else to see and I just happen to walk into it, then we'll buy it on DVD. Then if I'm flipping past it, that's definitely I'm flipping past it on when it's on Showtime.
I wouldn't even plug in my own headphones for the in-flight version of this. And, not to say nothing of the $5 the airline tries to charge you when, God forbid, any frickin' Walkman headset,
yep,
you can plug into the armrest and hear it. What did that happen? We were flying to Phoenix, my woman and I.
Yeah.
And the in-flight movie was, the John Cusack romantic comedy. Was it
Serendipity?
No, that was a couple years ago, although I'm sure that sucked too. The The one where it was about the personal ads.
Oh, yeah. Must love dogs.
Yeah. That was on the in-flight movie. And I let my girlfriend use my headphones. So she watched it for free. And every so often, because I was reading, and I'd look up and I'd see some scene on the monitor. And you could immediately tell what was going on. And I'd look over at her and she would just be embarrassed. She'd have this embarrassed look like, I can't believe I'm watching it either. Please don't think any less of me. And especially this ending where it's this ham-handed, like, she jumps off a boat, like, because he rows crew and she paddles over to him. And
did she love dogs? Was that the denouement?
I can't remember which one. Talking about the definition of formulaic, though.
Yeah, I can't stand watching movies on flights because I can't, for whatever reason, I can't concentrate on them. And the only ones I remember seeing when I was heading to Europe a couple years back, they were playing this movie called Diamonds. And it was this movie with Kirk Douglas and like his son and somebody else. And it was some unbelievably inexpensive movie where they're clearly trying to give him a role where he could, you know, where he could act after he had his stroke. And he was unintelligible. And they sort of explained, I think it was like a former boxer in the movie to explain why he had this horrible, horrible, speech impediment. But it was the worst. It was so painfully bad. Oh. And it didn't make up for it. And I honestly, for a while there, I felt trapped because I'm a kind of person who has to be staring at something, reading something. And there I was staring at something that was really, really bad. I just hated it.
Did you think to bring a book on the flight?
Well, I did. I just poured through them all. But at that time, I like couldn't concentrate on reading. I was like, I want to turn on this. That's why, boy, I hope every company on the planet, follows the JetBlue model from on out. Because you all get your own TV screen. You can change the channels. That's what every, airline
or
needs.
Or bring a second book.
Well, I remember when I went to D.C. a couple of years back and for this conference, and I remember taking my laptop from, it was when I worked at Paws, and I took my laptop and I brought some movies to watch, and I was watching I was watching Saving Silverman, which is a horrible, horrible movie, but I wanted it to be good because it was Jack Black and I thought it was going to be funny. Terrible movie. But about a third of the way through it, I realized, oh, I didn't buy the PG-13. I bought the unrated edition. As I'm watching this in an aisle, realizing there's about to be nudity happening. And I know that like the 50 people behind me can see my enormous screen. So I'm like immediately realizing, what do I do? Do I flip it down? I ended up just closing the thing down, just closing my screen down. Just because, I mean, there's nothing more embarrassing than watching naked people on your laptop with a bunch of other people standing around.
I really wouldn't know.
I wouldn't know either. I never happened, but I didn't want it to happen. Anyway, that's my little stupid story. So
wow, that was quite the tangent. Oh, failure to launch. That's what led us off into airplane movie land. What else is on the list here? Oh, I saw the little 30-second teaser for the Simpsons movie.
Yeah, it wasn't much of a teaser, was it?
I thought it was funny. Well, there's
the
two
Homer
jokes
thing.
In it.
Yeah,
well, three
true.
If you count the Superman
the
logo
Superman
thing.
Superman thing.
I think they're perfectly fine jokes.
Yeah.
And I will, of course, see the Simpsons movie because I am a gigantic Simpsons fan.
Yeah.
One of my superpowers being the quoting of Simpsons quotes. That's really about all I can do. I don't have any marketable skills, but
somebody supposedly described the plot of the movie and they put it on IMDb, but the plot, and they're going, and I haven't seen this in any Simpsons episode. And I'm thinking, have you never watched the Simpsons? So I don't know if it's the actual plot, but the plot they described was there's no way it's going to be the plot. And it's obvious. And it's obvious stuff that you're going to know going into the movie. I won't tell you if you don't want to do it, but it's not a giveaway in any stretch of the imagination. So, but anyway, needless to say, the plot they described was the plot of perhaps among the most famous Simpsons episodes ever. And it's like how they could say that this, I mean, I think somebody was just messing with somebody, but enough video sites started, enough movie sites started, releasing the details of the plot. And I'm going, geez, this is the details of Who Shot Mr. Burns season 3, first, first, the first episode before this, the second episode. But anyway, I digress.
You know, I think it's interesting because, you know, Simpsons is still a huge phenomenon. It's really popular worldwide.
Yep.
We don't really, I think, have an appreciation for that here in America.
That's honestly the only reason why it stays on, because its numbers are always okay in the U.S. But 10 years ago, it was like a number one show. Now it's like in the middle of the pack. It's not that many people see it each week. Not that many don't, but it's not hugely successful. But it makes so much money worldwide that they don't even have to show in the U.S.
But what's, you know, it's interesting to me in that I'll see it, but it's not like I've got to be there.
Yeah.
And it's like, if I want to see The Simpsons, I can turn on any TV channel any time of day, and odds are fairly good you're going to see one. You know, it occurred to me, actually, they've got over 300 episodes now.
Yep.
You could essentially watch a different one almost every day in an entire year.
Yeah.
Think about that for a second. You could spend a year, and maybe by now they've eclipsed the 356 number, you could watch a different Simpsons episode every day for a year.
You could watch it.
That's literally nuts.
It is crazy. You could watch it around the clock for a week and never see a different episode, pretty much.
And so I've always been kind of fascinated because there's this, you know, on the internet movie websites, that's redundant. On movie websites, they're always so excited about, oh, is the Simpsons movie, is it happening? Is it going on? I'm thinking, who cares, really? It'll happen sooner or later, but are you not getting enough Simpsons right now?
Well, I think, I don't know. It's kind of like from the standpoint of, you know, and some people didn't like it, but when the South Park movie came out, it was so terrifically much. It was like South Park, but it was bigger and it was different and it was a musical and it was different. And I'm not saying they should do that with The Simpsons, but I'm just saying it was an entirely different experience for me.
And you're right, but I don't really see that happening with The Simpsons.
I don't either, but you never know. I would assume that I would hope there'd be some musical elements, because those have always been some of the best parts of the show, from the monorail song to the Stella, you know, thing. So I'd hope they do something like that, and that might expand a little. You don't see those as much anymore. When you do, they did a couple with that Groundskeeper Willie a couple of weeks back. I didn't really like that, honestly.
Yeah, I think that was based on, was it My Fair Lady?
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe they'll do something like that.
Did you see the Ricky Gervais episode last week?
I did not.
It was pretty good. Being Gervais, and it was pretty good.
Or it's the final episodes of The West Wing, and
yeah.
I know I'm going to catch The Simpsons in the reruns, but I got a West Wing right now is taking priority.
Boy, between those two episodes, West Wing would be a distant 73rd. I don't know. I gave up on The West Wing.
I know you did,
ago.
But it's the final ones, so I am totally sucked in. And it's hard for me to articulate, but for me, The Simpsons movie, it's good, but it's always been kind of, okay, I'll see it when they finally make it.
Yep.
Whatever. It's always been kind of whatever for me. And this whole fanatic, oh my God, Simpsons movie, by everyone else.
Yeah.
It's interesting that I'm not on board with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you.
So our friend Mark emailed this, forwarded this this article from the New Yorker magazine?
The New York Times.
And it was basically Nora Ephron, who is a writer-director.
Yep.
Who
used to be married to Carl Bernstein.
I didn't know that. But yep. She wrote this article about this incredibly crappy experience she had going to see a movie in New York. And it was horrible.
Well, it mirrored all of the experiences you and I had screwed up on the frame, and then the thing got out of sync, and she was
I've never had a movie get out of sync.
I've never had that. Actually, I've had it on a limited basis, and I almost assumed that they have some kind of automatic software, because it would click back into sync sometimes, but maybe they were doing it. But I've had it happen a couple times where it got out of sync. But she was describing that, and then the framing got totally off in the screen, and it was like, and the big thing she was saying was she went to talk to people about it, and they ignored her. And that's exactly mirrors every experience I've ever had. There's no consideration.
I've only been really ignored once, and that was an after the fact. I've been, you know, I do not wait. When I realize something's out of frame,
yep.
I will immediately go up and tell somebody.
Yep.
And I've never been ignored. They're usually pretty good about radioing it in to whoever's running the projectors that day. So I'll give them credit for that. But there's been stuff like, my favorite was bent aperture plate covering, you know, the right rear corner. It was basically just black.
Yep.
And I went out to the snack bar. Excuse me, there's a problem with this screen. He's like, oh, yeah, the aperture plate's bent. okay, can you bend it back? We can't fix it. Then maybe put a sign up at the box office that this particular showing is going to be messed up.
Jesus. You know, the one thing I didn't like about the article, though, is Nora Ephron's a very funny, talented writer. And she's talking about that she was on the board of directors of Lowe's. And she talks, and she does this amusing anecdote where she says, they would sit there and discuss, and sometimes
she was on a corporate conference call, board of directors meeting.
Well, exactly. So she's on a conference call, and she just goes downstairs for 20 minutes to do something, and
she gets a manicure.
Okay, so she comes back up, and she comes back up, and everybody's yelling, and it takes her a while, and she doesn't want to admit that she wasn't there to ask what they're yelling about. And apparently, in the interim, while she was gone, it was announced that the company was bankrupt, and she was all upset. Because nobody had given her any inkling of this and that. And it's an amusing story, but I'm appalled. That woman has no friggin' business being on a board of directors, nor anybody else on that thing, if that was a surprise to them. There is so many corporations that are run into the ground, and the board of directors who get paid to be on their board of directors, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, to sit in a meeting like five times a year, absolutely, they're the ones that should be are the ones that everybody's expecting to be accountable. So it no offense, but it kind of, I'm just picturing all the little old ladies, just like with Enron and other places, that invested a bunch of money into a corporation, and then a lady joking about that she was getting a manicure and found out it was bankrupt. I'm thinking, if they're paying you $100,000 a year, you owe the investors of that organization a few hours of your time to look for yourself into those books and see what's going on, ask some questions. If any of that ever comes as a surprise to somebody, unless somebody is literally doing a criminal act and they're cooking the books and they're lying to you and covering it, then you are a horrible, horrible board member. And I didn't find that particularly funny. I found it quite offensive, but that's me. And I mean, she's a funny person, but it's like, boy, making a joke over that. I wonder if anybody else, I wonder if any of the investors in Lowe's who lost their shirt when they filed for Chapter 11 or whatever are laughing about her little manicure joke. But anyway, that's me.
And I get what you're saying. On the other hand, how could you not look at these big theater companies and see what they were doing in terms of all this investment, all this capital investment for making, you know, stadium seating and upgrading the sound systems and building all these large new theaters everywhere. I could look at that and say, you know, somebody's cruising for a bruising, to use a.
So in other words, what you're saying is that she really was bad and disingenuous, not just partially. She really should have known, and it should have even less a surprise.
I don't know much about how boards work. My understanding is, isn't there like usually a separate finance committee?
Well,
which clearly she was no part of. And you're right. There is a duty to be fully informed about as much as possible about what's going on. And the fact that a bankruptcy was declared coming as a shock is incredibly irresponsible. But it's kind of, there had to be a lot of self-denial going on to look at that and say, gosh, this company's spending all this money and there really isn't any uptick in revenue. Of course, something's going to happen sooner or later. Something's got to give.
Well, she just sort of implied that she felt that everything was run along smoothly. And I'm thinking what you and I are saying is that we would have gone in there and we would have been asking a few more questions, saying, okay, this is coming down the pike. What are we doing to prepare for this so we don't have to default? I think bankruptcy is a horrible, horrible thing, because bankruptcy is basically telling all the people who had confidence in you, we're going to take your money. You invested in us and your creditors, not just the investors, your creditors, the people that extended you credit, we're going to screw you. And I just think that if you know this stuff's coming down the pike, I mean, the reason they put Nora Ephron on that board was because a couple things. One, she is a prominent writer, so she's connected to the, you know, film director and writer, and she's also connected to social circles. Because she was married to Carl Bernstein and everything. So they thought, well, she's the kind of person we want to have the board. They didn't get her because she had any fiduciary responsibility. I'm thinking, that's ridiculous. You don't want that. You don't want to put somebody on the board just because they're adding to your cachet. And I think she recognized that. And if you're in that boat, then you shouldn't be on the board. I don't know. I'm just, this is my,
let's pull back.
This is my rant against corporate greed for the day.
Let's,
and I just think
let's
that,
pull back to movies.
Because I'm thinking of all those people, you know, when they went out of business, a lot of theaters got closed, actually, too, and a lot of other things happened. Think of all those people making $6.50 an hour. that have no idea. And then they're not fixing the bent plate because they don't have enough people to put in the, you know, they don't have enough people to even fill the slots.
Anybody
that they
who worked
fill.
At the theater that lost their job immediately found another one.
Wow. Okay. Okay. Mr. Moneybags.
I worked at a theater and it's, didn't pay jack squat.
I'm just saying if we're wondering about the horrible, horrible move going experience and she's sort of crediting the other stuff, I'm saying it ought to come back to her or the people who are running the show. They're the ones that can decide that.
People who work at the theaters don't make anything. So it's hard to blame them for not really caring about the presentation of the screen, the quality of the food. They're making practically minimum wage.
Okay. So whose responsibility is it? The board. Ultimately, they're the ones that run the show.
All right. You know, let's move on.
So anyway, I found it to be a funny article, but I was a little taken aback at how unbelievably blasé she was over billions of dollars of other people's money.
And, you know, let's leave the possibility open. Maybe she just did that as a writer's, maybe she was taking artistic license.
I would fully actually expect that. So
let's give that as a given and move on to, we have a couple of basic cable shows here. The first, Heist. I don't. Is that FX? I don't even know what cable network.
I think it is FX.
For.
It's there's something.
No, well,
they tend to put like one on. They have like Rescue Me, The Shield, and they put one or two big ones on at a time. Nip Tuck.
You know, I don't know hardly anything about Heist other than it's. Well, it's coming, and it's supposed to be. There's this trend now for these long overarching plots to go over the course of a single season or even a single show. A la Prison Break, where the whole thing is, so far it's all breaking out of prison, and then I guess they're going to do a season running around on the run,
yeah,
and then that's it. Two or three seasons and they're out, which I think that's actually a pretty good idea. Instead of just trying to milk this formula for, you know, first let's get 100 episodes for syndication, and then let's just milk it for as long as we can just to make everybody involved rich, and who cares about the quality. I think it's a good idea to do these single arc shows, which... God, what was that one with the, I remember they tried one like 5-10 years ago.
Like
with
Murder
the,
One?
Yeah, Murder One, which I didn't see at all. But it was like a
some
trial.
Some people loved it, but it basically, to fill it out.
It was a trial
it
over
was
the
all
course
melodrama.
Of
it was cool, but it was like all melodrama. You'd watch it in
so
there.
So it's not like it's a brand new idea.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I guess Heist is one of these, but it's one that Doug Liman is involved in. And I don't know. I don't want to say I've soured on Doug Liman because I think he's a great director, but
yeah, The OC is awesome.
Which I've never seen The OC.
I'm just joking.
Well, a lot of people think it is awesome.
Is it? I don't know. It just seems to me
Doug
in the long
Liman,
list of Melrose Place
OC.
And Beverly Hills 910.
And now I heard they're also working on doing a TV version of Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
You know that movie made a fortune.
I know.
It was and it's so funny. The guy can do no wrong, and every time a movie comes out,
the
guy gets
past,
savaged.
And yet the past few things he's been involved in, I don't care about at all. Which the last thing he did that I really enjoyed was The Bourne Identity.
That was awesome.
And I just
What did he do after that?
I think he did The OC.
Yeah, The OC. He was like heavily involved in The OC.
Anyway, it's just I don't know anything about this show, but I know that
I can't even muster myself to buy the DVD of. Although actually, I haven't even really seen it, but. I have not been able to muster the courage to even buy the Mr. and Mrs. Smith DVD.
It's a fascinating commentary because they're quite pleased with the end product.
They're so self-deluded. Well,
look at the money it made, and it's hard to... How can you be self-deluded when your movie made so much friggin' money?
Yeah.
And yet... And there are people who like it. It's not... I don't think it was savaged critically.
Yeah.
I think the critics were either... I don't know. I just... To me, it was just such a... They're trying for something specific and so completely missed the mark in my own estimation.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I thought I'd mention that. And then Thief, which is, I know it's on FX with Andre Brouwer.
Yeah.
Who's a fantastic actor.
Yeah.
I remember when I was living with my roommate, John, he was a homicide freak.
Especially the first 3-4 seasons. I literally thought there had never been a better show on TV.
And I thought it was very good. That's one of the few things that my buddy John was so completely into that I agreed with him on. There are a few other things and I'd be like, whatever, dude. But Homicide, I was great. And so he's in this and it's supposed to be another sort of an overarching multi-episode con job, which he's involved in. But there's also supposed to be this family drama where suddenly he's raising his kid on his own. And the kid is Anne from Arrested Development.
Oh.
The girlfriend that Jason Bateman never cared for.
Oh, nice.
Always trying to break them up. Oh, God, that was funny. But it's supposed to be a pretty good show. I haven't seen it. I don't plan on watching it.
Yeah, I remember when Homicide came out.
Trying to reduce my TV exposure.
Homicide is based on a book. A report.
Right, that an actual Baltimore homicide detective.
Yeah, it was like a report. Well, it was actually a reporter from the Baltimore Sun had spent a year following these detectives around the homicide unit. And I remember I had read that book, and it was by the creator of Homicide, the co-creator, who later went on to help create, I think, The Wire and other stuff. But anyway, he wrote this thing, and the first season of it, pretty much almost every episode was taken from incidents in that book. So the first season was it was kind of cool reading this book and seeing a TV series play out, and not in a way that most it's like they take a book and they condense it down to one movie. Here was like 20 episodes and each one taking an element from that book. It was awesome. And I remember watching that TV show just every week, just could not wait for it to be on. Then it kind of got old, but then towards the end it got better again. I remember, what was that one gal in it who was so hot? The Detective Ballard. Do you remember her? She was amazing. Every once in a while you see her turn up again. And what was that one guy in it who was so great too? Kyle Secor.
Yeah,
he was from Federal Way, Washington, right where we live. But he was like great.
Near. I don't want to claim we live in Federal Way.
But it was like, you're seeing all these actors, and I just kept thinking, boy, these guys are all superstars. They're going to go places. And for the most part, not many of them did. It was kind of cool to see, Belzer use the same character in Detective Munch and move to Law and Order. That was kind of cool. But the Law and Order he moved to was horrible, horrible show. It was like, wow,
he's
it's sort
on
of the
Special Victims Unit.
Yeah, but
I've never watched it. People like it.
I don't know why they like it, because it takes everything that's good about Law and Order and sucks it out of it. Because what they do is they've turned it into a melodrama instead of a drama. And the thing about the regular Law and Order, which was always great, was it was this by the numbers kind of dragnet drama. And Special Victims Unit is all about feelings and the other stuff. And it's icky.
It's icky. That's awesome.
You know, but it's kind of cool to see Belzer in there. Anyway,
I think it's interesting. There's more, you're seeing more and more, and maybe it's just that FX keeps doing it, more and more specific to cable channels, new series. And they seem to be taking a few more risks as things like The Shield have gained traction and
Rescue Me
that
and Nip Tuck. They've all done really well. I mean, relatively speaking, that's what's cool about is now the landscape is.
And yet I haven't seen any of them.
Well, Rescue Me's good. Shield, I had the same reaction the first couple seasons I did to Homicide. It was so great. But this entire last season, mostly because I haven't watched much TV, I flipped on FX and they were saying, the episode you can't miss, the series finale. And I immediately realized, crap, I missed the entire series. That last season they put bus signs on, so I at least knew it was coming on, but I was unaware. But that's okay. I'll watch it on DVD. So, anyway.
I just had an interesting note here. Battlestar Galactica, which is off air till October.
Uh-huh.
I listened to the creator commentaries for the episodes on my podcast iTunes thing, and something new popped up in there. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. There's not a new episode, so I check it out. And basically what they did was they recorded a writer's room session.
Oh, cool.
As the writers are discussing how to hash out an episode.
Cool.
And there's actually two parts to it. I haven't listened to the second part yet, but that's just so frigging innovative. That is so cool and so, I love it. I love the risks they take creatively in the show and how they're trying different things. Like, we're going to do podcast episode commentaries. We're going to let you listen to the writers hash out an episode.
Go ahead.
I mean, to people like you and me who love behind the scenes stuff, that's just like catnip.
Well, you know, it's funny. You know, I'm this huge Howard Stern fanatic. So Howard Stern has gone off to his $600 million
vamp
contract.
For a second. I got to answer my phone.
No problem. So Howard Stern has gone off for this, $600 million contract to do radio on satellite. But the one thing that's mostly incredible about it is that it is the most self-referential thing ever. And it's exactly like what you're talking about, where what they're doing is they're taking and taking every element of the show and playing it out. Then they're playing it out and referring to it in behind the scenes in additional shows and other stuff. So, for instance, what you're talking about is once every couple of weeks they have a show called the Friday Show. What I was mentioning here, Matt, is what they have is that about once
you don't need to sum up
the once that well because it's about because it's a conversation that you have to hear. So well, in other words,
I'm sorry, everybody,
it's okay. What we're talking about, it relates directly to, if you listen to Howard Stern right now, what you have is you have the regular show, and then they'll have like a wrap up show. And that with the wrap-up show, they have some of the people on the regular show, and then they talk about what they just heard on the wrap-up show. Then they'll have, like, the Friday show when periodically Stern wants to take a day off. And then they'll play, like, an entire writer's room conference where they develop a bit. Well, so you'll hear them developing the bit. You hear them arguing why it will work. Then you'll hear them play the bit out. Then later they'll have a wrap-up show to wrap up this.
Okay,
I see where you're... They're creating this incredible world, and it's if you're into that world... It's literally incredible. It changes everything because the entire, it's this self. And then they have the news where they report on that.
I get where you're coming from, but that's being driven by the fact that they have so many channels that they need to make material for.
No, actually, you're wrong. You're absolutely wrong.
I'm just
telling you as a big.
There's an article in this magazine I'm holding up right now where they're basically saying that.
No, I've read that. I've read the article, and they're wrong in the sense that what they're doing is Howard Stern is always. Howard Stern, in one sense, has the biggest ego on the planet. Now,
in one sense.
You know, in other senses, he really does not. He has no ego in other senses. But in the sense of just being, he's this radio personality that's bigger than life, and he created stations called Howard 101, 102. He has a new video on demand channel called Howard TV, and everything revolves around him. And when he's creating these shows, he was not creating them in a sense to just be all Howard all the time. He was creating a sense to create a world that revolved around him. And so, for instance, he created a news operation. This news operation has like 20 people working for them. And every one of their news segments is somehow going to be related back to Howard. So, for instance, they'll have somebody comes in and brings a sex machine toy for some woman to play with. Then they'll go interview the manufacturer. Then they'll go interview a doctor who talks about overusing sex machine toys and stuff. It's like the craziest thing, but it has to relate just directly to Howard. And then when they're doing the show, they're referring back to that. And I tell you, they're definitely not doing it to fill airspace. If they're doing it to fill airspace, they just keep replaying the shows over and over again. What they're doing is doing stuff that me and every other fan wants to hear. We want to hear the show. Then later, we want to hear about the inside, how they built that show. Then we want to hear fans comment on the show. It's an entire worldview that is unlike anything I've ever heard. And it's literally, if you're wondering why I don't watch TV anymore, it's because I'm listening to like twice as much Howard Stern. So I digress,
okay,
but it's I'm telling you, the same thing that's driving you to listen to the commentary or the behind the scenes of Battlestar Galactica, it is the same exact thing that's driving me and however many fans listening to other stuff.
I'm not arguing motivation on our part. I think that I think we're differing on the motivation on the producer's part that's fine.
I don't know. The shows are so highly produced and they're so enjoyable that it would just seem weird that it's a happenstance. They're trying to fill space.
Because
they could always hire more people that just come in. They've hired Bubba the Love Sponge and hired this guy named Pharrell, and they have radio shows on his network. So,
well, I know practically nothing about Howard Stern. You're the big Stern fan, so
yeah.
I'll give you the benefit of the
anyway.
Doubt
I just
that.
I find it holy geez, it is really raining, isn't it? I find it I've never encountered anything like that. It would be like taking my favorite thing, like let's say it was The Simpsons, and having it be 24 hours a day, and part of it Simpsons, and part of it is interviews with Matt Groening, and part of it is following the writers, and part of it's the writers' conference, and part of it's the development. I've never actually seen anything quite like this, and it's wholly satisfying for me. I mean, as a person who enjoys that.
Okay.
I imagine if I hated Howard Stern, it would be the single worst thing I could ever imagine. It would be like I'd rather be shot.
Well, you'd be like me, and you just wouldn't listen or watch or be involved at all, and you wouldn't care one way or the other.
Yeah.
Like myself. I have a note here, the Poseidon budget. You mentioned that the budget for the movie Poseidon, the new movie from Wolfgang Peterson, it's the remake of the Poseidon Adventure, was like $180 million.
Yeah, and that's before they spend money on marketing. So
that's, I had no idea it was going to be that much. Amount. All I can think of is that it's, the logistics of shooting all these water scenes where you've got your sets that involve water.
Yeah.
All I can think of is that must be tremendously expensive. It makes me think back to The Abyss, which, was a James Cameron film that, well, you talk about that is a great special edition DVD. It has my absolute favorite behind the scenes making of documentary.
Yeah.
And it was Under Pressure, the making of The Abyss, which it's like an hour long, but it's so well done. And, you know, they were behind the schedule from day one, and all this stuff of shooting everything underwater
in
and
a big old nuclear power plant.
Right. It was a power plant that never was finished in terms of the construction.
Yeah, so it was the cooling tower.
Right. Well, I don't think it was a cooling tower. It was a big cooling tank. I don't think the tanks are actually
in the towers.
Yeah. But just the nightmare they went through that was involved with shooting in water, and you can understand, looking at that, how anytime you shoot anything involving water, just balloons up tremendously. Waterworld being a large example of that. Although I think that was all on the water as opposed to sets.
Yeah, that was
crazy.
I don't
even remember. I only
Created this enormous set out in the middle of Hawaii.
Big, yeah, this big fake atoll.
Like, yeah, exactly. And it was literally enormous. It was like,
washed out in a storm, and they had to rebuild the whole thing.
Well, and this was the very, yeah, exactly. And this was like the very, very early days. It was like 93, I think. Very early days of computer animation. And they didn't put any in there, but they used computer animation to remove something because Kevin Costner apparently throughout the production had these little, he was supposed to be this kind of person that was becoming like a water person. So he had these little gills on his neck, but they looked like, apparently when they were rushing the movie, they looked like female genitalia. So when the whole movie came out, they systematically removed the female genitalia that was growing on the neck of Kevin Costner.
Glad I learned that.
It was right from Premiere Magazine. They did a whole big story about it. It was hilarious.
I don't know. I was astounded by the $180 million budget figure. And you start looking at it, you know, movies are just getting so ridiculously expensive to make. You look at that, you look at Superman with a budget in the neighborhood of $200 million. And you got to stop and think, I'm sure it'll make it back because that's a gigantic thing everyone's going to want to see. But you got to stop and think, $200 million, what can we do with that?
Yeah.
You know, as a society, what if we just didn't make Superman and we said, you know what, pretend we made Superman. Instead, we built X number of houses. We fed this many hungry people. It starts to, or not even that, you look at something like Failure to Launch, what, $30, $40, $60 million to make?
Yep.
Is anyone's lives enriched by that?
Yep.
I'm happy that the people that made it were able to make money working on it, and their livelihoods were enriched, but maybe take the $60 million and instead of making a movie no one's going to care about in a year, maybe help the poor with it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I run a nonprofit, and I have to raise $700,000 this year, and it kills me, and I'm thinking of all what I'm going to do, and I'm trying to picture, wow, $200 million, that's what, 300 times how much I have to raise in a year? I'm thinking how much good I could do. Now, I don't bemoan them. I enjoy these movies. It's just a weird set of economics that movies have gone up so much. You look at these movies that were the greatest, biggest movies of all time, like when Lawrence of Arabia got made. It took them 4 years to make the thing. Well, in today's dollars, that movie would be about a $40 million movie because at the time it was like $5 million and it was an incredible amount. Today's dollars, it wouldn't be much, but nowadays, literally they just throw scads more money on. And then it's not even something you can go do for 5 years. The longest movie takes maybe 6 months these days. So it's just incredible how economics have changed. And even today, throw movies that come and go in a couple of months that might be successful are literally three times as much as the epics of 10 years or of 40
yeah,
years ago.
It's just weird looking at, you know, couldn't you be much more efficient in how you spend the money and produce the exact same movie for a lot less if you did a few things differently? But
well, I know a lot of executives would hope that same thing.
And yet it never, anyway, I noticed, and maybe I don't know if it's just me, but I've noticed a lot more movie of the weeks lately.
Really?
Just the advertising. And like, I saw ABC is doing another Ten Commandments. Who? And it just got me thinking, A, who cares? B,
maybe they're getting tired of showing the dang old one year after year.
Well, it's clear that they're not going to do this unless they make money on it. And so it's just weird for me to think that there's this business model that says we're gonna make this TV movie and enough people are going to watch it that we can charge advertisers X amount of money. We can then take that figure, lop off 10% for our profit, and there's our budget for this thing. And it's just this whole circle of, because, God, I can't remember the last time I watched a TV movie, a made-for-TV, made-for-one-of-the-networks movie.
Yeah, I've watched some HBO movies, but...
Well, yeah, because well, there, like there you have an implied quality. But yeah. I'm looking at this Ten Commandments, and I'm thinking, who cares?
Well, speaking of them, you know, I bought the Ten Commandments this week. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
We'll get to that.
Okay.
But there's just a few. There's like Avenger with Sam Elliott as sort of an older Special Forces guy.
Well, that's obviously a pilot. They're making a movie to see if it's successful.
So?
Of course. I mean, look, just, I don't know anything about it, but the way you're describing it, it sounds like, let's do a movie, see how it does, so we can maybe have a series.
If it happens...
I know, the way you're describing it sounds like the plot for a series rather than an actual movie, but maybe I'm wrong. Although it's hard to imagine Sam Elliott, but...
Well, that's why I would say. I don't think he'd put up for the grind of a weekly show.
Yeah, but you know what?
That's a lot of work.
I've heard enough actors say, boy, you get on a weekly show and it becomes a hit. As they describe it, as David Spade used to describe, they go, why are you doing Just Shoot Me? And he goes, well, I was like, I had left Saturday Night Live and then this little money tree grew in my backyard. And I would go out in the back and once a week I'd shake the money tree. And that's the way they think of it. It's not that hard. Depending on how you do it, it's not actually that hard of work. And if it's successful,
well, the difference between David Spade on Just Shoot Me, the work he had to do every week, versus an action series where you're the main character.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see there's a big difference there in terms of the exertion.
Yeah.
Not to say that it's not hard to be on a weekly show if you're not jumping around and blowing stuff up, but... There is a difference. Anyway, there's that. And then there's this one. I wish I could remember the title, but it's directly analogous to Codename Knockout, The Omega Strain. And it's based on some Robert Ludlum book. And it's got like Angelica Houston and a couple other like C-list names. And it's just, oh my God, who cares?
Yeah, I hear you.
What? Rube is watching this. How do you are you watching the advertising and thinking that's appointment television? I'm going to write that down on the fridge so I don't forget to tune in 9 p.m. Sunday night to watch Codename Blah Blah.
Well, I think the bigger thing is like what's a similar show that they were trying to knock off to get people? So would it be wasn't there some like a CIA show or like or something like that?
The unit.
I think that's the audience.
That's like ABC's top new drama.
I think maybe that's the market they're going for. I'm just trying to figure.
I think you're right. I think you're entirely right. But I just, God.
Yeah, I can't watch it. It's funny when they you know they'll talk about something being a top new drama and I'll look at it and go, no, there's drama and there's drama. There's West Wing and then there's this crud. You know, and it kind of makes me mad that they don't have a term for cheeseball, JAG, NCIS kind of drama, you know, and real stuff something like West Wing or Homicide or something like that. There should be a different kind of term for those things.
I just remembered something else I wanted to
talk about. But anyway, I don't know. I can't even handle those shows. Fortunately, I don't even flip past them anymore, so I don't see them. But every once in a while, I'll hear about them. I'll go, turning this out.
The internal network advertising is hysterical. This is the most important episode of NCIS ever. And you're watching that going, wow, really? Okay. I still don't care.
Yeah. Great.
Wow. The most important zero is still zero. All right. Okay, you want to talk about the Ten Commandments.
Oh, yeah, so I got the Ten Commandments DVD, which was kind of cool. Because
I've never seen that movie.
Wow, I've seen it
This is the Charlton Heston as Moses.
Yeah, and I've probably seen it, parts of it, maybe 15 times. Because they play it every year at Passover or Easter. And basically, and it was kind of funny because it's always been the weirdest movie to watch. And it's really helped by, they have this historian, this lady who wrote a book about it and befriended a lot of people that made the movies. And she clearly loves the movie, but was pretty honest about it. And she basically says, you know, this is a movie you need to understand, even in 56 when it came out, and it was hugely successful. In fact, it was the most successful movie of all time at that point, until it was superseded later. But it was a movie made by an elderly Victorian guy, a guy who was born in 1880.
Wow.
And had, you know, Cecil B. DeMille, and he had Victorian sentiments. And when he was making this movie, they're going, this was not a modern movie, even in 1956 when it came out. It was essentially a Victorian passion play. So everything you see in there, all the way people are standing, it's like a passion play. It's like they're doing a play, and the tableaus and the way they greet the audience. And that actually helped me appreciate the movie much more. And some of the effects, which were kind of creaky, but had their own incredible beauty. I don't know. It was just kind of cool to see the movie again and see it like it. And what's also cool is they include the original 1923 version of the Ten Commandments on there. And that famously has like a 30-minute prologue that was filmed in a two-strip Technicolor.
Was it the Crimson Permanent Assurance?
No. It was very similar. To, you know, I bought that a couple weeks ago and watched that whole mess again. That was very funny. But that movie, it was so... That whole meaning of life, it was so different than other Monty Pythons. Watching,
well, you get distracted really easily.
Well, watching that movie in retrospect, it was like, it was definitely different than Monty Python, because it was almost like, not satire, it was surrealism. And parts of it were very funny, but parts of it were so weird, like the find the fish segment. You remember the segment?
Well, of course.
So it was like not like, it was brilliant, but different, and it kind of throws me. But anyway, so watching the Ten Commandments again, they have this 1923 two-strip Technicolor segment, and it's cool because I'm watching this going, wow, I'm watching color film from something that is almost 100 years old. Kind of cool. Anyway, so it was kind of fun watching the Ten Commandments again, something I've seen year after year after year, and to hear the reminiscences of this historian who knows it very, very well. It was a good commentary. Anyway, okay. I digress.
Well, no, you're not digressing. That's what we're supposed to be doing. That's one of the things that has captured your interest.
It's
and
all,
it's entertainment related.
Yeah, exactly. It's all
okay,
a digression.
So to bounce back to TV for a minute, have you followed what's going on with Commander in Chief at all?
No, I remember it's... Let me tell you what I know about Commander in Chief, and you tell me where I'm totally screwed up.
Let me talk for a minute.
Hang on. It came out... It was very successful, and then it started tanking in the ratings, and then they started firing people and freaking out. Isn't that what happened?
Well,
then they get rid of the creator, wasn't it?
Commander in Chief is the show where Gina Davis is the president,
and Donald Sutherland's
like the chief of staff
or Speaker of the House or something.
No, I think he's chief of staff.
Okay.
I have never watched the show.
Neither.
I've never had any interest in watching the show because I get all I need to from the West Wing.
Absolutely.
And I like Gina Davis. I saw her, what was that action film? The Last Long Kiss Goodnight, something like that?
Yeah.
I even saw that in the theater.
That was her big movie.
So you can't accuse me of not liking Gina Davis.
Well, it was directed by her husband at the time, Rennie Harlan. And then they did the Pirates thing and destroyed their marriage.
The new type of action film that will redefine action movies. And I'm still not quite sure what they meant by that. Anyway, it debuted very well. I didn't know about the ratings collapsing, but there was some, they basically kicked out the creator. They gave him a development deal. It was like a golden parachute kick out. I can't remember his name.
Yeah, no, it's the guy who did another presidential movie. Who was it? Anyway, very prominent guy, and it was like
a well-known name.
And then they brought in Stephen Bochco.
They brought in Stephen Bochco, like 4 episodes later, they kick him out.
Oh, did they? See, I didn't know that.
That's what's interesting to me. And so now they're on like their third executive producer, their third essentially showrunner.
Wow.
It will be a miracle if that show continues. To go through that big a change twice.
Absolutely.
To maintain any sort of consistency with the writing staff, with the actors not feeling jerked around. will be amazing. I've never heard of that happening before, where you've shuffled the important people behind the scenes, really even once. I don't know, but I haven't really been paying attention to that sort of thing in the history of TV, but that's just nuts.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible, and you just got to wonder what exactly is going on.
And so I see this, and so I saw a TV promo for the next episode, and like she fires her whole cabinet. And like someone's going, that's insane. That's an insane move. And Donald Sutherland, it's the boldest move you could have made. And I'm watching it going, who cares?
Oh, man, that sounds painful.
Who cares? Oh, anyway, I found that interesting that they're on their third executive producer. And like, what, two seasons?
No, it's one season? This is the first season.
Wow.
This is it.
Who cares? Anyway, we're ready. I'm ready for an interactive segment.
Okay.
My buddy John subscribes to Entertainment Weekly. When he is done with them, he gives them to me to recycle. So I'll read like four at once. And this last one had this full-page ad, which is just, to me, an astounding full-page ad. Sure. And I am now going to show you the full-page ad at Entertainment Weekly, which you have not seen before.
Okay.
And
I may have seen, because I actually have that issue, but I didn't read it from cover
to
cover.
I want to get your reaction.
Is this the Howard Stern issue?
No.
Oh my God! Oh.
It's an ad for. I'm going to come around behind you here and try and describe this. As do you want to? So it's for All Aboard Rosie's Family Cruise. It's an HBO movie, and the ad is three quarters of the ad is the ocean, and there's this cruise ship on the horizon, and it's leaving a wake, and in the wake are rainbow colors. And then the bottom quarter of the ad, you see Rosie in like a Captain and Tennille get up, her arms outstretched. It's like she's singing. And then there's the title information, All Aboard Rosie's Family Cruise. I would like your reaction to this full page ad in Entertainment Weekly.
Well, you're tempted to say it's the single gayest ad in the history of ads, but then again, that's
it
clearly
wants
the,
to be.
That's the thing. It's clearly the purpose with the rainbow stripe. But it's actually that this picture of Rosie, it almost looks like it's like a mock-up for an ad rather than a real ad, because you can't really tell that's Rosie very well. But I think that's interesting. They're calling it the family cruise because it is for gay people and their families. And I think it's a kind of a cool, honorable thing that she put together.
Which is fine. But this ad.
Yeah.
Because with advertising, with marketing in general, you've got. It's like, who's your market? Who are you trying to reach with this? Are you trying to reach people that you think will be interested and maybe haven't heard of it? Are you trying to reach people in a completely different segment? Like you're trying to do outreach? And so something like this, are you appealing to gay people? Are you appealing to straight people that may be interested?
Yeah.
Are you
trying to like have straight people that have no idea but still want to get them in, but not offend them by making it, because if they don't recognize what the rainbow means or.
Which is interesting because I thought everybody knew that. And yet a former coworker of ours who I won't mention by name so as to avoid embarrassment, they had no idea that the rainbow colors was code for gay.
Would the initials be EC?
Yes, they would.
Oh my
but
God.
Let's not embarrass that person any further. And, you know, if they don't come across that, I can kind of understand. And so this rainbow wake, it's kind of a, well, I know it's a gay thing. And the word family is kind of code name for gay.
Well, I guess the question I have is, who's the audience, who reads Entertainment Weekly? Because it's mass market, but I would venture to guess it's mass market, but it goes more into the territory of more knowledgeable people.
Right.
But mass market, so your friend John is probably the... And you and I are the target audience for this. So I'm wondering.
And yet neither of us, of the three of us, would ever in a million years watch that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I have zero interest in watching this whatsoever. But I don't know. Maybe they're going for the people that are intrigued by Will and Grace. Maybe. I don't know. It's weird.
The composition of that ad, I think it was just the gigantic rainbow wake and Rosie in her captain's getup.
So executive producer Sheila Nevins, Kelly O'Donnell, Rosie O'Donnell. Kelly being Rosie's wife.
Significant other.
Yeah, she took her name. Honestly, I thought it was cool. When I saw Rosie got married.
I think the idea of the project
I know,
is fine.
Just here,
My issue here is with the ad.
I know, I agree. I personally can't stand Rosie, but when I saw her at San Francisco coming out after getting married and she was talking about it, I thought I was kind of moved. I thought this is cool that people are finally taking advantage of that. It's too bad I so totally can't stand Rosie O'Donnell because I thought, boy, if it had been, if if it had been, I don't know, hot actress here, I might have been more into it. But anyway.
Hold on. Speaking of which, I'm going to go off the list now. You see that Rebecca Romijn, no longer Stamos, has her own show?
Pepper Dennis.
Which looks horrendous.
Yeah, but it's been getting
really
relatively good reviews. It's been getting like 3-star reviews.
I've been seeing more negative reviews than that.
I don't know. I saw a couple 3-star reviews.
Just because you mentioned hot actress, and I think she was the first hot actress that came to mind. And
yeah.
Boy, if you're John Stamos, how do you let that divorce happen?
Well, because the guy, I mean, he can screw anything that moves that he wants.
Rebecca Romijn.
He's as good looking on the male sense as she is on the female sense.
That's fine, but.
Hey, I agree.
You're not going to do a lot better than Rebecca Romijn.
I agree, but if she drives you bonkers, at some point you realize I can do equal and not be driven bonkers. Maybe that's it. I don't know.
That's just that's sort of like when people come to you with they've got this question. It's like, what should I do here? And gee, I don't know. That's equivalent to which supermodel do I date that wants to date me?
Yeah.
don't just enjoy the fact that no matter what you do, it's a good situation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, I just wanted to mention Rebecca Romijn and in my mind picture her hotness for a little while.
She is hot and getting hotter.
Okay. Let's review your recent DVD purchases.
Okay.
And since we're now in the portion of the episodes here where people are actually able to hear them, we should now point out that Richard has approximately 900,000 DVDs.
Yeah, and as soon as our website's fully functional, there will be a link so you can see all of my DVDs.
Wow,
and
really?
You can see the latest to the earliest.
Our website is pretty functional.
I need to put that link up there.
So Richard has almost 1,000 DVDs.
Well, you're only looking at half of them because the other half
is
in my room over there.
Well, I'm gesturing because I'm part Italian. I don't expect people to understand. But it's insane, and as I've said in the past, and will say in the future, if you want to avoid the whole Blockbuster Hollywood Video Netflix thing, get a friend to buy 1,000 DVDs, and essentially whatever you want to watch, they will have, and you can borrow for free. It's a fantastic system to have. Well, yeah, but out of 1,000, you have a wide variety of DVDs here. You have everything from obscure German films no one has ever heard of to Sky High.
Sky High,
so
great movie.
So you run the gamut, my friend.
So here's the ones I bought. You know, they always have the 4 for $20 and
you pretty much now only get them from the used bin at Blockbuster.
Yeah, almost.
So it's like not like you're buying them all new.
Well,
you're,
sometimes I will. Like the Ten Commandments I bought new, but usually that's at Costco, and it's those special editions that don't make it to the Blockbuster.
Okay, so yeah.
But I did buy The Manchurian Candidate. That was, you know, that's a fill-out movie. I liked it in the theaters, but I'm not a huge Jonathan Demme fan. But
you should describe what fill-out movie means, because I don't actually know what you mean, but just from, know what you mean.
You got to buy 4 movies for $20, and I've picked 3, and I got to pick that last one.
Yeah, I knew that's exactly what I thought you meant. That's
so
brilliant.
I got that, but at the same time, they also had a cool documentary I wanted to see about Shirley Chisholm called Chisholm 72, Unbought and Unbossed. This was like the first African-American elected to Congress since Reconstruction in like the late 60s, I think from Georgia. And she launched a candidacy for presidency in 1972 that didn't go anywhere, but they did a documentary about it. And I thought that might be kind of cool. There's a movie called Incident at Loch Ness that I think was directed by one of the Penn brothers. And apparently it's not a very good movie, but it stars Werner Herzog, who is my favorite director, and just seeing him even starring in a movie I thought might be kind of cool. So I got Spartan, which is a David Mamet movie, and mostly like David Mamet movies. I avoided this one because it has a single commentary track on it, and it's by Val Kilmer, who I possibly hate more than any other actor in Hollywood.
I on the other hand have no hate towards Val Kilmer.
So hearing him in a I'll change my mind if I listen to a commentary track. When I heard the Bull Durham commentary track with Kevin Costner and
Tim Robbins,
I enjoyed that so much. I thought he seemed pretty easygoing. Kevin Costner did not seem particularly like vain, and I thought, boy, I got to give this guy a second chance. I kind of enjoyed it. So then I got this movie called Thunderstruck, and I know nothing about the movie, but it's pretty clearly a movie about people that are on the road, probably following AC/DC in Australia. But what's funny is
that hits you right in the exactly. right in your powerhouse, my friend.
But what's funny is nowhere, anywhere on the movie, on the marketing of it, does it mention the words AC/DC anywhere? Well, you can see it sort of in a little thing, but it doesn't say
the cover.
So it doesn't, but it doesn't go into any detail about this thing here. You see a little Bon Scott thing. So I'm going to assume when I pull this open, it was one of those movies where they couldn't afford any of the music from AC/DC. So we'll have to see. But anyway, just it was interesting. And I did find Bubble there, which was the big.
Yeah, I'm very interested in seeing that.
And I decided I definitely want to see this movie because Ebert gave it 4 stars. And I decided I don't want to know anything about this going into it.
Yeah, I know practically.
And it's
practically
got a Soderbergh commentary. And of course, I found Mirror Mask, too, which I've been looking forward to seeing. So, and it's got commentary tracks, too. So it,
I know
like,
it does.
Proves to be good. So I have a full year of movie watching ahead of me, considering I'm so far behind. I think I'm up to about 50 movies I own that I haven't seen yet. So I really got to get my act together. I mean, some of the movies you've even borrowed and I haven't even seen yet. And I just got to get
which I do feel guilty about.
No, don't feel guilty. I've got like 49 more that I still got to get through. But it's like, and I'm looking over there, I'm seeing other movies that I still haven't seen yet, like on my wall. So I got to get my butt together. I got to quit my job and just start watching movies.
If only someone would pay you to do that.
I have to have my priorities together.
Advertisers, if you're interested in sponsoring Mustard Ayonnaise and subsidizing Richard's quitting his job and watching movies, or, you know, if it's a good enough package, Matt also quitting his job
Absolutely.
And watching movies, we're...
You can contact us at...
Well, for that one, you could do... our contact
rock.
Email, youguysrock@mustardayonnaise.com.
Absolutely.
And if you have a comment, even if you don't want to sponsor our show or advertise on our show, because really it's kind of crass to be... to be shilling for that.
Exactly.
If you just want to comment on it, you think we're stupid, youguysrock@mustardayonnaise.com.
Exactly.
You want us to talk about something? Give us a shout. Perhaps we'll talk about it. So are we about
we're
done?
At one, we're 1 hour and 1 minute and 48 seconds.
That's our target length.
Exactly.
I should say an hour-ish, not really the hour and 1 minute. Nothing else you want to talk about?
No, I think we're done.
I think we're all right. Then, as mentioned a moment ago, youguysrock@mustardayonnaise.com. Go to our website, mustardayonnaise.com. And at the moment, there's not a lot there. But there might be soon.
Absolutely.
All right, I kind of trailed off into retardedness there. So I'm Matt.
I'm Richard.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.